Sports talk where your voice counts. This is the Steve Jones Show on WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motors Studio, filling in for Steve Jones, here's Kevin Herr.
This is the best of the Steve Jones Show. Kevin Herr, as the man said, filling in for the vacationing Steve Jones again today. Steve back with us Monday. We're a busy month of August as we get ready for Penn State football coming up at the beginning of September. Of course, Bucknell Bison football. So we'll be chatting with Coach Joe Susan of the Bison, getting ready for the start of that season. Lots of NFL football guests coming up as we have a busy month of August. We're also going to talk Little League World Series, Pocono IndyCar race, and a IndyCar race series right now that is down to about a 9-point gap between Juan Pablo Montoya and Graham Rahal as they get into the last two races of the season and the last quote-unquote oval, which is actually a triangle, at Pocono later on this month. Right now, we remind you of the conversation we had that we like to call an exit interview with Dave Paulson as he was leaving the Bucknell Bison men's basketball program to head to the D.C. area. And then we're going to chat with Nathan Davis, the new coach of the Bucknell men's basketball program, here on the Best of the Steve Jones Show.
Dave, congratulations on the move.
Thank you, Steve. It's a great feeling, and it's a bittersweet feeling. You know, it's a tremendous opportunity to take over at Mason. You know, tradition-rich programs made a run of the Final Four, plays in one of the best basketball conferences in America. But it's bittersweet to leave my guys at Bucknell and Lewisburg and all the people who have been so supportive to our program and to our family every step of the way.
As you make the move and you look back at what you did at Bucknell, how proud are you by what you accomplished and the foundation that you've left?
Well, you know, I'm just proud because more than anything, the best thing we had was we had some of the very, very best representatives of the country on the floor in terms of the character of the young men I was fortunate enough to coach. And through great seasons or maybe seasons that weren't as successful, they always really played extremely hard, were very coachable, and represented themselves well. So, you know, that's the first thing. And obviously we had a good amount of success, but that goes to the territory of Bucknell. You know, Bucknell is a great job. It's set up for success. There's a lot of support there, and I was happy. You know, really, I think when I got hired, a lot of people were like, hey, you're inheriting some pretty big shoes, don't screw it up. And hopefully at the minimum these people say he didn't screw it up too bad.
What made George Mason appealing to you?
Well, I think the tradition, you know, what they've been able to accomplish in 2006 going to the Final Four under Jim Larrañaga, a couple other NCAA tournaments after that. They've certainly fallen on harder times in the last few years. But I think the potential, you know, there's great potential here. And much like what I found out when I researched and found out about Bucknell, there's great passion to have a successful basketball program here.
All right. Now the next part. When you take a job and you change conferences and perceived to be changed a level into the mid-major level, what does that do in terms of your recruiting list as to opening the door to recruiting different players and the adjustment that you and your staff have to make to a new list?
Yeah, you know, now the first few guys I called last night were guys on my list at Bucknell who were like, boy, if we could get one of these guys, these guys are program makers. And, you know, at this time of year traditionally at Bucknell, we were calling guys that a lot of times we didn't get, you know, that ended up going to quote unquote higher level. You know, I think you can make the argument there is no higher level than us now, you know, and obviously the Atlantic 10 is a team, it's a multi-bid league. Teams from the Atlantic 10, George Mason, VCU, have gone to Final Fours. So, now certainly there's a perception that you're not a Power 5 conference, but I think you can go toe-to-toe with anyone. The interesting thing will be to figure out there was a certain niche, there was a certain cell that was attractive to kids at Bucknell. I think the learning curve is, you know, what are the key selling points at George Mason? Who are the guys we can get? You know, what types of young men and families and high school coaches does this cell resonate with? And that's the first thing. And the second thing is, you know, learning, hey, where not to waste your time. And so I think there's a learning curve anytime you change schools and jobs, figuring out, you know, what's going to be your pitch and who's it going to most resonate with.
You chose basketball coaching as your profession. You've now lived it for a long time. What is it about coaching basketball or being a basketball coach that drives you and allows you to love your job on an everyday basis?
Well, I think the first thing is you got to love the kids, and you got to love watching them grow and develop and getting to know them. And the hardest thing that I had to do was walk in the locker room on Monday afternoon at 5 and say goodbye to those kids. And one of the things that I literally just came up for air is having individual meetings with every one of our guys here at George Mason and trying to get to know them and forge relationships. And, you know, you got to have some trust. They got to know how much you care before they care how much you know. And so that's the most important thing we do. At the end of the day, we're not solving world hunger. And we're not going to balance the budget in the Capitol Hill. You know, it's I think what happens when young men grow through the experience of intercollegiate athletics, learn some skills that, quite frankly, are more transferable and more valuable than anything they might learn in a classroom.
What about now the fact you have to learn a lot of new opponents? I mean, obviously, at Bucknell, you scheduled really well. You scheduled really well. But there's going to be some opponents you're going to have to play now a couple times a year that maybe you haven't seen for a while. What's the learning curve like that in the off season? Because, you know, between now and the start of the season, it's one big learning curve.
Right. You know, it just gets accelerated. And this is a great league, and it's a great coaching league. And that's exciting, but it's also a little bit daunting. And, you know, typically what we would do if I was still at Bucknell, you pretty much know the key things that teams like to do in our league. And you know the actions that you have to spend more time on guarding. So there is a learning curve. You know, there were teams in our league like Army and American, and I would guess now Holy Cross with the system that Bill Carmody put in. You knew what to expect, so we spent more time working that kind of stuff than maybe what we're going to have in the Atlantic 10. And I got to figure out, you know, every league to some degree takes on a character of its own, and
exactly.
That's going to be off-season film study to figure out what are the key ingredients that you really have to be able to do to have success.
Something I never talked to you about, Dave, in all this time, but I'll talk to you about it now. And that's about Patrick Chambers. You've known him for a long time. You also know what the Penn State job is like. How do you, as a fellow coach who understands him and understands the job, does Penn State have the right fit with the right guy?
I think absolutely, unequivocally, yes. Without a doubt, I am a huge Patrick Chambers fan. One of my 285 unreturned text messages is from Pat. I have developed a great friendship and relationship with him, and that's not why I'm saying it. I think, you know, the Penn State job is a great job, but it's a hard job, would be my layman's evaluation of it. It needed a lot of energy, and Pat's provided that. You know, I think there was a time there when they were really struggling there. They really made a great run at the end of the year, which was great. He's recruited exceptionally well. The group of guys that he has committed to come in next year and then the year after even, I think he's got one in there, it's great. Now, you can send a message to him that he kind of came into the metropolitan Washington, D.C. area to get a couple guys, and that's going to end. Okay, so you can send them up as much as I like them. We're putting a sign. We're going to put an X through his face on a milk carton and make sure that people know he's not allowed at the DMV anymore.
I will let him know you mentioned that. The other part, I want to ask, George Mason talked about what they did a few years ago and what Jim Larrañaga did in particular. You have the Patriot Center, for example, and I've done a couple of games in that building. I like it. Do you feel good about facilities and also commitment at the university to what you want to do?
Yeah, I really do. They really want to be good. They really want to win. I really loved the president when I met with him, and you know, I think at least initially, I'm undefeated right now. We had a good bond. I think it's a great facility. I think they need to make some upgrades, and I think those are in the plans. And you know, there's always a, going from the Colonial Athletic Association to the Atlantic 10, a learning curve, I think, for the administration in terms of cost of doing business at that level, and they've already made some adjustments. So, you know, I don't know everything yet. It's I can find my way from the hotel I'm staying at to my office, and I was able to find a couple of Diet Mountain Dews along the way. So that's about all I know right now. But there'll be a big learning curve for me. But that's exciting and invigorating as well.
Dave, they're very lucky to have you, and you'll do a tremendous job there. I'm completely confident of that. You're one of the best. Thanks a lot for all the time that you gave us in your tenure at Bucknell. It was greatly appreciated, and I enjoyed all the talks we always had.
Hey, Steve, I enjoyed it. I always look forward to the Monday call, and I appreciate your support and obviously all the listeners and all the great fans who support our teams over the years, and they're going to have some really good teams down the road, too. So thanks so much.
And Coach, Coach, thanks again for making my text one of the texts that you were able to respond to. That means a lot. And doing a couple of games with you over the years has been a ball. And I was so happy when we won that last one and that you were able to let me do more games then after that.
Yeah, absolutely. But we're not going to let you do any games out here, Kevin.
Oh, come on.
I can't have a 1-2 record. All right.
Hell, Dave, now you know I feel every day.
Best of luck,
Thanks,
Coach.
Dave. Take care, guys.
Good
Thanks.
Luck. Bye. Thanks. We'll come back with more in a moment here on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Let's bring in the new head basketball coach at Bucknell, Nathan Davis. Welcome home, Coach. Great to have you with us.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me on this afternoon.
Well, let's get to your first experience here working with Pat Flannery. What did you pick up in that particular time about the culture of Bucknell and the capabilities of Bucknell that now comes into play as to what you want to do moving forward?
Well, I think that, I mean, it's a great question. I think that what it did was it just reinforced what I thought coming in, that you have a great group of people that work here, from the administration through the athletic department to the coaches. You have highly motivated, intelligent young men. They're capable of doing great things, and I'm fortunate to be a part of it once again.
Now let's take the next step. Head coach at your alma mater, Randolph-Macon. It's one thing to be an assistant. It's another thing to be a head coach. What did you learn in the role of head coach to go in combination with what you now know about Bucknell that will really benefit you moving forward?
I think there's a couple things. The first is that you've got to always keep your eyes on where you're going and have a plan in place and know how you want to get there and be willing to execute that plan. Understand there's going to be good times, there's going to be bad times, but as long as you're organized and have put a lot of thought into it and prepared yourself, you're going to be in a good position to get done what you want to get done. The second one was just dealing with different people, from administration to media to other coaches on the staff, to players. There's a lot more that goes into being the head coach than being the assistant coach, as far as the amount of people you have to deal with on a daily basis, and remembering all the way that you have the final say. So no matter what, good or bad, at the end of the day, it's going to come back to you.
Yeah, you are the CEO, and yes, dealing with that darn media, Nathan. All right.
Oh, the media is the best part.
Oh, nice comeback. Well, very smooth. Well done. Let's get to what will, in your list of priorities, what are some things in the first couple of weeks that you must take care of?
Well, the first thing and foremost is you obviously have a really good team returning, a lot of young guys. It's been certainly a challenging time for them with some of the uncertainty going on, and making sure that they feel good about the direction of the program, that we get a chance to know each other, and that they feel good as we get in the summer about what's going on here, and are excited for coming back here in the fall. Got to finish getting the staff assembled. Got to get started with recruiting. Those are the next two things. And we have a big alumni outing with the 2005 reunion coming up at the beginning of May, and trying to get yourself organized for that stuff as well.
All right. In terms of the getting to know the players, as you mentioned, David put together a nice young team that grew as the season went along. What will the process be like for you to get to know these guys? Because you have to know which one, you know, how each personality works. So what's your process there?
Well, it starts with we've had a team meeting now, and I'm sitting here as we speak. I have individual meetings scheduled throughout today and tomorrow. And then just having them around the office, getting a chance to see them in the gym here, around campus, getting the chance to catch up with them, talk to them on the phone, texting, all that stuff goes into it. It's not going to be a thing that happens overnight, but I think we're off to a great start, and I'm looking forward to getting going.
Obviously, how the current players are is going to figure in as to how you're going to play. You just can't fit square, pegs into round holes. You can't do that. Idealistically, what style would you like to end up playing here at Bucknell when you and I sit here and talk 4 or 5 years from now?
Well, I think that the big thing offensively will be we want to share the ball. We want to be unselfish. We want to have balance inside and out with being able to throw it in the guys in the post, being able to drive the ball, being able to get shooter shots on the perimeter. Defensively, it will be about we want to protect the lane. We want to make guys shoot contested jump shots over top of us. We don't want to give up any open threes. And we don't want to give up any layups. There's a number of ways we can go about doing that, from man-to-man to playing matchup to playing zone. Offensively, it can be motion. It can be different calls. But I'm a big believer in you got to take a look at what you have each year and figure out what the best way to utilize it is. And so that's the way we'll go with it.
Obviously, there's also the value of the three-point shot. How does that figure in as to the kind of players you want to recruit along the way? Because you and I know if you shoot 33% in threes, it's the equivalent of 50% in twos.
Well, I think the best way I can put it to you, my philosophy on shooters, is that when the ball goes to the basket, coaches look a lot better. So we got to find some guys to put the ball in the basket.
They make you look better every time when they do that. There's no question about that. You know, of course, the Bucknell culture and the importance of academics. What does that do to the pool of players that you feel strongly you can recruit that fits both cultures of academics and basketball at Bucknell?
Well, I think there's no doubt when you combine the academics and the basketball ability we want to have that the pool is going to be a lot smaller than other places. But there's certainly throughout the Mid-Atlantic and across the country any number of guys that fit that profile. It's our job to go out there and do our research and get out and see them play and find them and convince them that Bucknell University is the place for them.
One of the areas that over the years, I know I've watched, obviously I was here when Penn State transitioned into the Big Ten, and I remember in talking with the Nebraska people when they were entering the Big Ten, they said, what do you think the toughest thing will be? And this was from a football point of view. And I said, look, it's going to be, for your coaching staff, it's going to be learning 8 new opponents because that's what Penn State had. You get a feel for personnel year to year. Basketball's the same thing. That's why I gave Mark Turgeon a lot of credit what he did this year at Maryland, to come in and learn literally 13 new opponents, and they handled it well. But, you had to get your staff going, but what are some of the keys when you have to go in? Because you had to do it at Randolph-Macon. You had to learn new opponents. So what's that process that you like to go through that makes the transition as a coach as to how to counter certain things in advance?
Yeah, I think that, the big thing is once you get through the part of the stuff we already talked about is getting a chance to sit down and going through film, and with all the video editing equipment and things you have going on today, we're going to be able to go through and watch all those teams over and over again and get a good feel for what teams are trying to do. And then, of course, we'll have to apply that to what we're doing to figure out what the best way it is to use our guys in order to win those games.
This can be, obviously, an all-consuming job. So how do you like to relax? How do you like to get away where nobody's asking you questions?
I have a great family, so it's always nice to get home at night. I have a 9-year-old boy, a 7-year-old girl, and 2 twin 3-year-olds, or almost 3. It's always great to go home because it doesn't matter what's going on that day. They're just happy to see you. They want to play. They want your attention. There's no better way to take your mind off the other things going on than to spend some time with those guys.
2 3-year-old girls?
Actually, the twins are it's a boy and a girl.
A boy and a girl. Okay.
Yeah.
So, I had a coach tell me one time who had 2-year-olds. You know what he told me? best part about 2-year-olds that they do become 3.
I would agree with that, but I'm starting to think the best part about 3-year-olds is going to be they become 4.
Very good. Yep. What about that process of moving your family here as well? I mean, and having to try and do your job, but at the same time finding a spot that you're going to try and settle down in.
Well, fortunately, I've been married to my wife now for 15 years, so it's not our first move. She's unbelievable as far as her ability to handle things on her own. So she's down in Ashton right now, running the kids around to school and getting them out of that and starting to get the house organized and look for places to live. So once the school year's out, hopefully we'll have settled in and know we want to live and have found a place we can move permanently and get that taken care of in the beginning of June.
For you, what is the potential of Bucknell basketball? What can it really be?
You should put a challenging question out there. I don't want to put myself in too much trouble and set the standards too high. They're already very high. But I think, obviously, having been here before, knowing the type of support we have, knowing the type of quality individuals we're going to be able to attract to the program, the sky's the limit. I think we can compete at a high level. I think that we'll be able to beat a lot of really good teams. And any given night, who knows what happens. But we want to make sure that one thing's for sure is that we are working on being as good as we can every single day. And if we can do that, then we get to the end of the year, the rest will take care of itself.
For you personally, what did it mean when you found out that you would be the head coach at Bucknell?
It was surreal, I think, is the best word. I think that when I look at the job, I haven't been here before, I know what a great situation is. Coach Paulson did a wonderful job. I never thought that he would ever leave. I doubt the opportunity would ever become available, and when it did for John Hart and the administration to think that I was the right guy to lead it is certainly a great honor, but it's still kind of surreal. I'm trying to wrap my head around it at the moment as we get started.
Well, you're a great hire, and we appreciate the time you gave us today, and we look forward to working with you as often as possible in the years to come. Thank you so much for carving out some time for us today.
Thank you for having me on anytime. I'd love to talk to you again.
Well, there you go. In that half hour, the outgoing interview with Dave Paulson, former Bucknell men's basketball coach, and then the first interview of the incoming coach at that time, Nathan Davis. Of course, Nathan, not an incoming coach now. He's still a rookie coach at Bucknell anyway. Not necessarily a rookie coach, but a rookie coach at Bucknell. We'll put it that way. He's not necessarily incoming anymore. He's already here. Jim Delaney was here as well in the month of May. We'll have Steve's conversation with Jim coming up in the next half hour on The Steve Jones Show.
This year marks Sunbury Motor Company's 100th year in business, and we will be keeping the same tried and true values we've had ever since we opened our doors, guaranteeing your car buying experience will be smooth and hassle-free. No spinning a wheel for specials you don't need or want. No pushy sales staff pouncing on you as soon as you arrive. No sideshow yelling. Since we began back in 1915, we have strived to be your most trusted friend when it comes to all of your new car needs, whether that's in sales or service. We strive to offer you as many viable options as we possibly can. Sunbury Motor Company always carries a line of few other auto dealers in our area can compete with. With our inventory of Ford, Hyundai, Kia, and Lincoln vehicles, there should be no problems with finding the right vehicle to fit your needs. Our friendly and trustworthy staff is knowledgeable in all of our products and stand ready to answer all of your questions and meet all of your needs. In honor of 100 years in business, SMC is introducing the all-new Auto Club, where Sunbury Motors will pay you for every mile you drive. Be sure to ask us about our Auto Club benefits. Sunbury Motors in the North 4th Street Auto Plaza and at sunburymotors.com. Proudly owned by the Mertz family since 1915.
Sports talk where your voice counts. This is the Steve Jones Show on WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motors Studio, filling in for Steve Jones, here's Kevin Herr.
Best of the Steve Jones Show this week, where tomorrow we'll talk more Penn State football. If you missed any of the conversations from Big Ten Media Day last week, we'll have Coach James Franklin's comments. We'll have Jack Ham coming up as well, talking about no names on the jerseys and a little Penn State football. And we'll even have some Penn State recruiting with a member of Blue White Illustrated, one of the best places to find out Penn State recruiting information. Well, next to the Steve Jones Show, of course, but we have a lot of different sources that we use to try and bring you the information. Even though Steve can't, under NCAA rules, talk about any of those players, we can find ways around that legally here on the Steve Jones Show. This is the best of the Steve Jones Show. Kevin Herr filling in. And about May, late May, right around Memorial Day, Steve caught up with Jim Delaney, the Big Ten commissioner, and had a conversation about sports in the Big Ten, Penn State's addition to the Big Ten and what it's given the Big Ten, as well as that TV contract.
Just outside Chicago in Rosemont, the commissioner of the Big Ten, Jim Delaney. Jim, welcome. It's great to have you with us.
Thanks. Appreciate it. Appreciate being on.
Jim, June 4th will be exactly 25 years when Penn State was voted into the Big Ten. In general terms, every partner brings something special to the table that's really helped you along the way. What has Penn State brought to the table for you and the conference?
You know, looking at the big landscape, the big picture, because Penn State was the first major expansion, there may have been others, Arizona and Arizona State in the late 70s, and Georgia Tech to North Carolina. But really, when you think about the five major conferences, to my recollection, it was the first mover. And so with all the other moves that have occurred, to be honest with you, some of them are really good, great fits. Some of them maybe not as good. But I always thought, and then and now, that it was a no-brainer simply because of the common characteristics of Penn State and the with reference to the existing Big Ten membership at the time, a major research institution, you know, quality undergraduate program, a broad-based sports program, exceptional national reputation in football, located in a contiguous state, member of the AAU, with lots of faculty having had shared experiences. And so the way I viewed it then and view it now is not that dissimilar. I knew that Penn State faced east as an institution. Institutions do face in a direction, and I thought that was positive. And I think it's turned out to be a very positive thing as the world has unfolded. Penn State has really acted as a bridge for the Big Ten to become a more significant part of Eastern culture, whether it's sports culture, political culture, media mm-hmm. culture, financial culture. It's where a lot of our people live. It's where they work. And I think Penn State's being in the conference for, you know, 23 years before Rutgers and Maryland came in has really aided and abetted the integration of both of those institutions. And but I thought it was the best fit, a natural fit. Looking back on it, not much changes in my mind about that. The only thing that I would say that I wish I knew more about expansion, integration, branding, 25 years ago than I know now, because, you know, we would have done much more than we did. And that's sort of on, you know, the world, it's on me personally, but I just don't think that we thought as much about it, acted as much constructively to really spend time, embrace people, make them feel more welcome. And, you know, we certainly did it more with Nebraska and more with Rutgers and Maryland. And, you know, I regret that, but it wasn't for a lack of goodwill. It was simply for a lack of experience and staffing and sort of awareness of what expansion really meant and how you could really make the best of a good situation by actually working harder to make everybody feel good.
And in fact, that was going to be my next angle to you, was going to be about what lessons had you learned from Penn State that opened the door to make Nebraska, Maryland, and Rutgers an easier transition for them?
Well, you know, think about it. You know, 1990, we had 15 television games. You
right.
know? We had 8 or 9 on ABC, regional, 1 national with Ohio State, Michigan, and we had 6 games on ESPN, and ESPN was 10 million homes smaller than BTN. So the world has changed tremendously. The conferences have gotten to be more significant influencers of competition, of media. I think we've all done well in promoting ourselves and our schools. I think we realized, certainly I realized, probably, you know, 6, 8, 10 years in, that I hadn't done everything I could have done. So I started thinking about not only more expansion, but thinking about how I would do it differently if I could do it again. And I think that just means getting into the neighborhood. It means embracing and acknowledging, you know, people's different traditions, making them feel more welcome. And, you know, I don't care if it's a new person at work or whether it's a new friend or a new institution in a conference. I think those things are really important.
Jim, you mentioned in that answer television, and obviously everyone wants to ask you about television. You think about it all the time. But there's also something else with it. The New York, I think, Daily News ran an article back in February that millennials are falling off TV sets at 10.6% rate in the past year. That's at 18 to 34 group. But that doesn't mean they're not watching things. They are on platforms. Does this now open up a wide range of thought for you as to platforms when you sit down to really null this out?
Yeah, it does. I mean, we've been studying the marketplace for 10 years and maybe 8 years, 10 years since we, we went with the Big Ten Network. We knew technology would continue to morph and change. I think we had 350 events that were on the linear network or streamed in 2007. This year will be closer to 1,300. So a lot of that is digital. A lot of that is on Big Ten to Go or expanded Big Ten. A lot of it's international, globally available. So, yeah, the methods of distribution are wide-ranging. I mean, it's from the internet to cable to telco to over-the-air to satellite. And that's not going to change. Cable has had a tremendous 25-year run. I'm not sure how many more, 100 million home platforms there'll be. But certainly, with watches and phones and tablets, man caves, you're going to get people watching in a variety of circumstances. And it really is about how many people are watching and what's the business model around that. There's technology change, there's consumer behavior change, there's also regulatory change. Comcast and Time Warner deal was not approved, but it looks like Charter and Time Warner are trying to make a marriage, and that will get regulatory approval. So you have technology, you have regulatory approval, you have consumer taste. And so monitor and watch that all the time. Understand that sports is special, college sports in particular is special. And, hope we've made some, I think, wise decisions in the past, and hopefully we'll make some more ones, some more good ones down the road. But there's no doubt about it that change is occurring. We have a good idea about the marketplace and the landscape, and our schools work together exceptionally well to present themselves for media opportunities when they arise.
The O'Bannon case, which you testified in, is in appeal. The Kessler case, which nobody talks about, is out there, and Nigel Hayes is one of the plaintiffs. So I don't want to get into the depth of that, but what have been the challenges of trying to stay ahead so the model is what you think is a good model for intercollegiate athletics, but also for universities? What have those challenges been?
Oh, they're significant. I mean, it reminds me, the challenges to society and culture maybe in the late 60s where everything was being challenged. I think it's good preparation. I grew up during that time, and every year there was something cataclysmic happening, whether it would be Watergate or whether it was Vietnam or whether it was the assassination of political leaders, civil rights leaders, urban tumult. Everything was being challenged. And so while it's not as serious as that period from a societal standpoint, it feels like that from a collegiate standpoint because all the basic foundational elements are being challenged. I think it sort of operates at three levels. I think you have to do your business, compete, make sure everybody's eligible, assign the officials, get games on television. So that's one level. Another level is that I think you have a responsibility where you still have some control over policy to drive an action-oriented, progressive agenda to make sure you find the sweet spot, the balance between the student, the university, the team, the fans. And to do that in a way that, is educationally based and, as a result, sustainable. In some areas, we have lost the ability to direct our own destiny because the federal courts are involved. And then the third area is the area of federal litigation. And people, certainly have the right to bring lawsuits, plaintiffs, that there's plenty of plaintiffs attorneys around to accommodate them. We have the right to defend ourselves in the federal courts based on principle. And so how those things play out are sort of to be determined. I think it was a Jenkins case. I think Kessler is the attorney, but it's the Jenkins case.
That's right.
And the O'Bannon case. And, those will play out. I mean, some of them, are ones that are so fundamental that it's hard to see how there would ever be any kind of compromise or settlement. And therefore, I think they'll play all the way through the court system. And I guess the last thing I would say is that they're all statutorily based. These aren't constitutional issues. These are antitrust issues.
Right.
These are labor law issues, and these are Title IX issues. And so at the end of the day, we're a country of laws, and they will be adjudicated, and then Congress will look at it. And I think it'll actually take, a number of years for all of this to play out. So I look at it as three arenas: operate, make the changes you should be making, and then also to defend yourself where you think it's appropriate to do so.
And under that realm, you floated your readiness last year. It was never a proposal, despite what people think. It would never was. But you floated it out there because you don't want intercollegiate athletics to be a minor league. Is that a fair assessment just in terms of getting ideas out there?
Intercollegiate athletics, sponsored by universities, has got to be obviously part competition, but it's also got to be, legitimately part educational.
Right.
And my sense was, in looking at these two sports, that we needed to improve some of the outcomes. So how one goes about that, there are a variety of approaches. I came up under a four-year scholarship. We've gone back to multi-year scholarships. I grew up under $15 a month laundry. We've gone to cost of attendance. I also experienced some form of a year of readiness. And so given the underperformance in these two sports academically, I thought it was a good way to shine the spotlight, to raise ideas and concepts, to share with the public as well as the thought leaders around the country. And, if this is not the right approach, that's fine. Really, we've been away from it for a long time. Maybe it's not. But then, what are the other ideas that people have? Because certainly the status quo and the secondary and the perception and reality in some cases of the secondary nature of education in the process is not good, it's not healthy, and it's something that we're still in control of that I think we have a responsibility to rebalance.
As you told me before we started this, I mentioned the new rules in college basketball that are still to be officially voted upon next month. And you said, Steve, we played fast. We were playing in the 80s under Dean. What do you think about the proposals that cleared the first hurdle, and how interested are you to see what they can do for the game?
Well, I'm interested and supportive. I wasn't on the rules committee, but I had a chance to be around the rules committee process a little bit for a variety of reasons. And, I'm glad that they made the changes. I would tell you that there's no panacea. It is a combination of coaching and playing and rules and officiating. But, clearly since really 1970, 71, which is the high point in scoring, 1 year after I finished school, we went then on a precipitous 12-year drop. 12 years in a row we dropped points. Then Ed Stites led the rules committee to two changes, the shot clock and the three-point shot. We regained in 8 of the next 9 years. And then we had another 12 or 13-year precipitous annual drop in scoring. So for whatever reason, the physicalness of the game, the imbalance, defense favoring over offense, the game is losing points. We had one exception in 13-14. But we quickly dissipated whatever gains we made in that year this year. So I'm hopeful that we'll continue to study it, that we'll investigate different tactics, because I think that, your point about earlier about the millennials changing their viewing habits, some of us are old enough to remember when bowling, horse racing, and boxing were the three most highly rated sports in the 1950s. So nothing is guaranteed when you're dealing with the popularity of a sport. It can come onto the horizon. It can disappear. And we have a responsibility, I think, to the extent we want our game to be viewed and attended and enjoyed, to position the game in a way that there is appropriate balance between the offense and defense.
You and I remember Bo Burton getting into the arguments with Billy Packer about bowling versus basketball on TV. So, one final question, then I'll let you go, and we thank you for the time you've given us. You talked about the bridge to the East. The Big Ten tournament returns to Indianapolis this year. Then it'll go to the Verizon Center in D.C., then Madison Square Garden at 18, and Penn State will be a part of the first basketball-hockey doubleheader involving the Big Ten on January 30th. When you've gone around, what kind of reception do you perceive the Big Ten has received in those markets, but also what is the perception you've received from others in the Midwest about having them in the conference?
Yeah. You know, I would say, to answer the first question about the reception and the reaction of the public, our fans, our alums, the casual sports fan, I think it's been really good. I mean, our teams are already playing a dozen games in the New York area, whether it's at Barclays or the Garden, or in Philly. And so, you know, we've been doing that for many years. The truth is that there's a lot of competition of all kinds in that Eastern corridor. So we're just glad to be there.
Right.
We've got a lot of people living there. Between Big Ten alums and Rutgers and Maryland, who are now, you know, in alums living in that area, we've well over a million people. They're all married to someone. They all have a couple kids. So you can get to 4 or 5 million pretty easy without talking about the casual fan. So I think, one, they're going to be appreciative of that. Probably 20% of our alumni base is probably located in that area. So I'm going to say over time, I would expect we have 20% of our championships out that way.
Wow.
We are a conference that lives in two regions, in the Midwest and the East. And we have one kind of member, a Big Ten member. And so there's going to be no exclusivity of championships. We'll have events in Omaha. We'll have events in Chicago and Indianapolis and Washington. And in the case of Washington and New York, I wanted to make it very clear as early as I could, the first opportunity we had, that we're going to have events out there, because we're clearly not visiting. We're clearly living. Got off New York, got a satellite office in D.C., had our first two lacrosse championships out there, had full distribution of BTN up and down that corridor from New York to D.C., New Jersey, Northern Virginia. And, you know, we intend to be a full participant in the sports community. We live there. We want to play there. We want to be part of it. Having grown up in New Jersey, I know exactly how competitive it is, and unless you're the Yankees or the Redskins or the Giants, nobody dominates. I think there's a play for us, and I'm very excited. As far as about the people in the Midwest, they're Big Ten people. They have pride in the Big Ten Conference. They look around and realize that, you know, Utah and Colorado probably are not in the Pac-12 original footprint, and Missouri and Texas are not in the SEC footprint.
Right.
And Indiana, Pennsylvania, New York, and Boston are not part of the ACC footprint. And so in a world where all the major conferences are in two regions, historically they're in one, we recruit students and student-athletes and faculty and donors nationally, and we call our schools global in nature, global in reach. So I think that while some people wish yesterday were today, it is not. And therefore, we're gonna constructively build, and Rutgers have been great. New partners, and I think we have been active in making them feel fully part of the Big Ten, and I think that's how it should be.
Jim, on behalf of everyone, thanks so much for giving us your valuable time today. We appreciate it, and thanks for all you do for the conference.
Well, thanks for being part of it, and thanks for having me on today. Appreciate it.
Well, that concludes the Best of the Steve Jones Show for today. Tomorrow, we'll talk Penn State football from the Big Ten Media Day with Coach James Franklin. We'll have Jack Hamm and a conversation Steve had with Jack as well, and a lot more of the Best of the Steve Jones Show to come tomorrow and Friday. Steve back on Monday to get ready for the season. And I'll tell you what, it's going to be a busy month of August with the NFL just down the road and starting up, as well as Penn State football and that Little League World Series going on in South Williamsport. Talk to you tomorrow on News Radio 1070 WKOK.